From PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and Sandberg Media, LLC, I'm David Dalt with Things Not Seen.
You know, a lot of these churches that are in that situation are in amazing spots. They're in amazing locations. And pretty much in every corner, city, town, village in the United States. And so they not only have like their own opportunity, but there's this also like systemic social opportunity to really make the most of that while they're in that position of being able to do so.
Things Not Seen is made possible in part through the generosity of our Patreon supporters. If you'd like to join them, please go to patreon.com/notseenradio. That's patreon.com/notseenradio. Thank you. Welcome to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're delighted today to welcome to the show Mark Elsden. He lives and works at the intersection of money and meaning as an entrepreneur, nonprofit executive, and speaker. He's the author of We Aren't Broke, Uncovering Hidden Resources for Mission and Ministry. He holds degrees from the University of California, Berkeley, Princeton Theological Seminary, and the University of Wisconsin School of Business. Mark Elsden is an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church USA and lives in Madison, Wisconsin. Today we're talking about his recent edited volume, Gone for Good, Negotiating the Coming Wave of Church Property Transition. Reverend Mark Elsden, welcome to Things Not Seen.
Great to be here.
Well, I want to start our conversation in a bit of an odd place, and it's actually not mentioned by you in the writings that you bring in to this book, Gone for Good, but by someone else writing about you. You are in Louisville, Kentucky, and you're sitting down with the mayor of Louisville, and you two are having a conversation. I would love if you could take my listeners and I into that room with you. What are you talking about, and why are you talking about it?
Yeah. That was an interesting conversation. I was having a conversation with the mayor of Louisville around this question of church real estate, church property, buildings, and land in the Louisville area. And in part because there was a really interesting project that emerged in an under-resourced part of the city there that was quite transformative and involved some of the folks that I know through some other denominational networks. But I wanted to ask the mayor what he thought about church property, because I'm really interested in this question as church membership declines and involvement declines, and therefore the question of church real estate becomes more pressing. I'm very interested in what municipal leaders, mayors, planning departments, and so on have to think about it. And in some ways, for him, it was a new idea to think about the scale of this transition, how many church properties are changing. But on the other hand, as a mayor of a city like Louisville, he'd been familiar with a number of church property transitions going on and also opportunities that there were there in the city to make use of that property in new ways for affordable housing or new business incubators and the like. So it's quite an interesting intersection, you might say, there between the city level and the church level, sometimes an intersection that doesn't very often happen.
You used a term there that I'd like to dig into a little bit. You use the word under-resourced, and I wonder, when you're sitting in a room with a politician and that word arises, what is that word attached to? What is it saying? And perhaps even more important, what is a word like under-resourced not saying in a conversation like that?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, I think it does depend a great deal on who's saying it and what context it's being talked about. Often it relates to parts of cities where there has been white flight, for example, cities where there has been redlining, perhaps, where certain racial groups have not been allowed to own property, cities where there has been underinvestment by the city itself or by developers or by businesses. There's all sorts of loaded issues related to that, of course, and historical issues related to how those parts of cities became that way. And I think in general, that's probably the way people often use the term. And then it becomes a slightly generic term of under-resourced. But In any case, there's a lot of parts of cities in America like that. And there's a lot of churches in those places, right? And in this particular case, in this one in Louisville, there was a church doing incredible work, really just the church building itself was falling apart, but the pastor and the parishioners were serving the neighborhood in a myriad of different ways. And they were the resource or a resource in this community. And so there's also a bit of a misnomer there with under-resourced. So it might be underfunded, perhaps, or some other sort of structural dynamic going on. But generally, those neighborhoods are full of amazing people and amazing things going on from the folks that live there. And that was the case in this particular neighborhood in Louisville.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Mark Elsden. He lives and works at the intersection of money and meaning as an entrepreneur, nonprofit executive, and speaker. Today, we're talking about a recent book that he edited called Gone for Good, Negotiating the Coming Wave of Church Property Transition. Well, we're still doing the part of the conversation that I like to call setting the table. So I'm trying to get some pieces in place so our listeners understand both what the scope of what we are talking about is, but also what's at stake. And I think a way to really make concrete what's at stake is a statistic that came out of one of these essays from your edited volume, Gone for Good. And I want to make sure I've got this right. Every single day, currently in America, 75 to 100 churches are closing. First of all, is that statistic accurate?
It is as far as we know. This and related statistics all need a little asterisk next to them because as far as I'm aware, nobody's got really incredible research data around this. But that statistic has been named as fairly accurate across a number of different people looking at it from different angles. And yeah, it's as of 2019, we've entered an era where more churches close each year than are opened. And the numbers are quite large.
And so when we look at a number like that, 75 to 100 churches per day, that seems to point to a term like a crisis, but it seems to even point past a crisis to an absolute collapse. Now, these are my words, not your words or the words of your authors, but when I use words like that, that these churches are in crisis, that churches generally are in a state of collapse. Does that sound hyperbolic? Does that sound like it's right-sized? Would you use a different word? What do you make of my terms here?
I would say that it's enormous. Perhaps a crisis could be a word used. I also think it's an incredible opportunity, and perhaps we'll come around to that in a minute, but I never like to start this conversation without naming that right off the bat. I would call it a massive shift. We use the word in the book tsunami. So it is a major shift going on in both the religious life of America as well as the social fabric and community life of America.
Well, and this is something that I think comes out really clearly, especially in the first section of your book, Gone for Good. And I love that you shifted to start talking about this as an opportunity. When we're talking about church closures, we're not simply talking about square acreage or square footage. We're talking about an abundance of social relationships and social supports that these churches represent in their given communities. And I wonder if you could take a moment or two and line out for my listeners, what are some of the things that a community loses when a church just shuts its doors and its congregation either vanishes to the wind or moves to a different location?
Yeah, I think we often underestimate how much churches do in a community beyond their worship life, which as a pastor is very important to me as well. But beyond that, where do the Girl Scout troops meet or the other scout troops meet? Where does the neighborhood association meet or AA groups? In my city, we vote mostly at churches. A huge percentage of our polling places are churches. One of the chapters includes this also incredible statistic by Partners for Sacred Places that did a study of the halo effect of churches. And they found that in a select city, they found that 91% of the visits to those churches were for something other than worship. Only 9% of the visits that people made to those churches over a year were for worship. The rest were for all these other things. visiting a food pantry, even maybe just a small one that's out of a closet of a church, but to pick up a couple items of food when the bills are tight that week, or to show up for a community meeting, for a senior citizen gathering, for a meal of some kind. I mean, there's so many services like that that I think we often underestimate the role that churches play. And I've been reflecting on the fact that as a society, we're losing a lot of those sort of semi-public spaces that don't require you to buy something to enter. There's not many places left in our society where you don't have to pay for some, you know, even a Starbucks, you have to buy a coffee or something, right? If you're going to get together with someone there generally. Maybe libraries would be a similar sort of thing to churches. But other than that, there's not that many of those sorts of things. And of course, we're building community centers and other stuff, but churches have been doing that very thing for decades upon decades. And so, yes, as you say, when churches close and leave, it isn't just the worship life that is ending or just a building that has nice, pretty stained glass windows that's no longer accessible, but there's actually all this stuff going on, this social infrastructure that's existing that has to either change or disappears.
As we're moving towards our first break, let's continue to set the table here. What are some of the key things that have shifted, maybe in the last decade, that have begun to drive the momentum of this tsunami, to use your words?
Well, we've seen some of the statistics recently that actually aren't really unpacked a whole lot in the book, but they're out there all over the place around just the declining participation in Christian religious life, at least in the United States. I think one of the Pew studies suggests that by 2070, less than half of Americans will be identifying as Christians. It might even be as few as a third, depending on how those trend lines continue. So it's just the reality of the way people are engaging in their religious life has changed dramatically. I've sometimes described this as a little bit like a Blockbuster Video moment, kind of like when Netflix came onto the scene. And Blockbuster Video stores suddenly found themselves not particularly useful anymore. I used to go and rent a DVD, you know, every once a week or something like that, and then return it 3 days later. But as soon as Netflix started sending them through the mail, and then very quickly streaming them, we just didn't access films that way. I would argue that people still want to watch movies. They do. And I would argue similarly, people still want experiences of the divine. They still want to be in carried community with each other. They still want to be a part of something bigger than themselves, something purposeful. But I don't think they're accessing those experiences through Sunday morning worship services and Sunday school in a big hallway of Sunday school classrooms in a church the way they were, you know, some decades ago. Now, that's not to say every church is going to close or every church is going to shrink. That's absolutely not the case. And that's where the Blockbuster analogy breaks down a little bit. But I think by and large, generally speaking, across the aggregate, the number of people engaging in traditional church activities and traditional church spaces is just dropping precipitously. I mean, very, very rapidly and very, very deeply. And so that's what's led us to this. Well, now we have all this real estate, this space, these buildings, these spaces that were built for that purpose that people are no longer going for those purposes. And therefore, what are we going to do with that space? That space has become just not fit for purpose, so to speak, the way it was at one time. And we built a lot. The American church built a lot over a period of decades. And we're now in the right sizing moment.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're delighted today to be speaking with Mark Elsden. He lives and works at the intersection of money and meaning, working as an entrepreneur, a nonprofit executive, and speaker. He's the author of We Aren't Broke, Uncovering Hidden Resources for Mission and Ministry. And today we're talking about a recent book that he edited called Gone for Good, Negotiating the Coming Wave of Church Property Transition. We'll be back in just a moment.
Things Not Seen is brought to you in part by Liturgical Press. Liturgical Press is a trusted publisher of resources on liturgy, scripture, theology, and spirituality. They've evolved to serve the changing needs of the Christian church, and they produce resources for pastoral leaders, teachers, engaged learners, and all leaders looking for quality books on faith and culture. Lit Press books are available at your favorite book retailer and online at litpress.org. That's litpress.org.
Welcome back to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. If you're enjoying this conversation, please go to our website, thingsnotseenradio.com. There you'll find more than 10 years of these sorts of interviews and conversations, all available for free for your listening pleasure. We're delighted today to be speaking with Mark Elsden. He lives and works at the intersection of money and meaning as an entrepreneur, nonprofit executive, and speaker. He's ordained in the Presbyterian Church USA and is a resident of Madison, Wisconsin. Today we're talking about his recent edited book, Gone for Good: Negotiating the Coming Wave of Church Property Transition. Well, I wonder if we can talk about the dynamics of a church. So if we think about what a church is for, and I'm scare quoting for here, it's about an hour to 2 hours on a Sunday morning, maybe a couple of hours on a Sunday afternoon, and maybe for Protestants, something happening on a Wednesday night. I think of my Catholic parish here in my neighborhood. Every morning, it's got a little bit of 45 minutes where that real estate is being used, and there are three services on Sunday. But otherwise, this huge amount of space is just wide open and empty. So am I describing the typical church, or do you have a different picture to paint for us about how church space is utilized when a church is vibrant and vital?
Yeah, I think you're describing how many churches have used their space for quite a while. I actually have a statistic in my previous book, We Are Broke, about a denomination did a study in North Carolina about the use of their space. And they found that on average, this was pre-pandemic, buildings were used about 17% of the week. That's a pretty underutilized resource. And that was pre-pandemic, right? I think since then, that's probably dropped in many cases. And of course, the pandemic raised all sorts of questions about what does it mean to be the church when we don't even do what you just described? We don't even do the weekly gathering together because we can't. I think, though, if I were to broaden that and say, what is the purpose of a church, if it isn't about the use of the building or if it isn't simply about worship life in those traditional ways, when I kind of go back and look at, you know, the New Testament and other stories of what the church was, to me, it's a gathered community of people engaging in their neighborhood and engaging with their neighbors. And that can be much more and much broader than that description we just talked about. And so this is where I think there's a great deal of opportunity with regard to the repurposing of some of these properties that are no longer being used for large worship services and classrooms and so on, but they could be used for small business entrepreneurship or for a commercial kitchen used for food entrepreneurs or co-working spaces, for example, even that draw people in a community that would otherwise never attend a worship service, or some of the bigger developments that are happening, like affordable housing on church land and those sorts of things. To me, all of that is church. It's actually the way that people live in gathered Christian community in their neighborhood. And we may have, I might argue we've lost a bit of that. We've narrowed that too much in the kind of height of the American church experience in the 50s and 60s. So I'm interested in this question of, can we like rebroaden that a little bit, explore opening that up a little bit more, and what does it mean to be the church, and then make broader use of some of these properties for the good of the other?
So a few months back, I had a guest on Things Not Seen, Reverend Celeste Kennel Shank, and she wrote a book about growing up in a hybrid Christian community. It was multi-denominational in the Washington, D.C. area. And after a few generations, they discerned together that their time as a community had come to an end, and they underwent a process to begin to give the property back to the community. And what I really loved about your book, Gone for Good, is that you talk not only about the emotional side of this process, but some of the practical sides of this process. And you introduced a concept that hadn't come up in my conversation with Celeste Kennelshank, but I found really useful, this idea of pre-planning. Can you talk to us about what this is and how it is useful for a church that is beginning the process of thinking about what might come next for its community?
Yeah, I often use the word pre-development. Yeah, pre-planning is good. And I've seen, it's a bit of a reaction to what I've seen, which is often churches get to the very end of their road and then call a real estate agent and put a sign up in the front yard and just put it on the market. And so I can understand how you end up there. But what I'm interested in is backing that process up a little bit. And can we start that just a little bit earlier? Your story is beautiful. I love that idea of intentionally saying, what are we going to do with this piece of land and this building? And what's its legacy going to be? And it may involve the church staying. It may involve some remnant of the church staying, or it may not. It may involve the church completely closing. And I've seen all versions of that happen. But that question of what is the legacy of this property going to be, I think is really important. I sometimes ask church leaders to just envision, close their eyes and envision the church property that is their beloved space 50 years from now. And think, what's happening here 50 years from now? And what are the decisions that we can make today that will influence and impact what's happening here 50 years from now? Even though we probably almost certainly won't be here at that time, the decisions we make today will influence what's going on then. So pre-development is that kind of, again, it's before calling a developer to come in and build something. It's before calling the real estate agent. It's before just throwing open and renting out your building. It's that thinking about who are we? Who has our congregation been? What do we love? What do we care about? And then who is our neighborhood? Who is around us? What are the needs around us? And also, what are the great gifts and opportunities around us? And then connecting those things and trying to listen for where God might be working and where God might be inviting the congregation to think differently about its space. And I've seen this happen with churches all over the country through my work at Rooted Good. And it's really amazing what people come up with when they just pause to listen and reflect, to actually have conversations with people like mayors or school principals or the neighbor that walks by every day at 7 a.m. with their dog or whoever it might be, and just try to think about what role can this piece of land that we have been entrusted as steward of play in this community.
Let me say back to you what I've just heard you saying around this idea of pre-development. And I'm going to sum it up both based on what you just said, but also drawing on some ideas from the book Gone for Good. This process of pre-development is reconnecting with a church's mission and reconnecting the church to its community. Now, when I say that, have I got it right? Or would you add something to that mix that I'm missing?
No, I think you absolutely have it right. And that if that the starting point is, yeah, reconnecting to its mission, who they are, and then reconnecting to its community. And then from those practical things start to emerge, you know, as far as development and as far as new social enterprise ideas or new business ideas or, you know, eventually lawyers and contracts and things like that. But it all starts with what you just described there. Yeah.
And so if we're thinking about a church's mission, the sort of great commission that is given in the Gospels is go and make disciples of all nations. And so a church that is in the midst of thinking about what the next steps might be, including possibly closing itself as a church, how does a church avoid thinking of itself immediately in that moment as a failure? Because we have failed to go and make disciples. We have failed to grow the congregation. How does a church psychologically overcome the barrier at that moment to just feeling like they've completely lost their rudder at this moment?
Yeah, and that's a good question. Certainly, there's a great deal of grief that comes with some of this. Certainly, closing a church brings a great deal of grief for the people involved, for the people whose family are connected to it. I hear stories regularly of people saying, you know, my parents' church, for example, is closing or closed, or the church that I was baptized in. And there's a lot of grief there. And I think just recognizing that is valuable and not sort of brushing past that. Also, though, the Christian faith is one of death and resurrection, and not just death. And also, I think sometimes we, when we say the church and the sort of the Great Commission or the call to spread the good news or bring the good news to people, is really the call of Christians largely, and the church at large, not necessarily just the call of one individual congregation. And so we're situated our individual congregations within the context of a larger movement of God in a community or in an area. And so it isn't necessarily, I don't believe, failure for an individual congregation to reach the end of its life as that sort of a congregation, and then to re-envision the use of its property, and then to hopefully bless its neighborhood and bless the efforts of others doing work in that area. I don't think that's necessarily failure. I can understand why we might feel that way, but it's also going back to that Blockbuster video analogy. Was it really the manager of the Blockbuster video store's fault when the social circumstances changed so quickly and so dramatically around them? I mean, there's nothing that that video store manager could have done to keep the store open, you know, put up more signs, put up different movies on the shelf. None of that would have made any difference, really, in this sense. Now, but, you know, maybe corporate Blockbuster could have done something different. But the people on the ground were responding to what's around them. And that is the situation of us in our churches. It isn't anyone's fault that we're here. We are just here because things change. People change. The way God moves changes. I don't believe for a second that God's going anywhere or God's declining. I don't think that's true at all, but I do think the way we're experiencing that is just changing. And so I guess I wouldn't call it failure. I would call it change, but recognizing that, yeah, there is some sadness and some pain associated with that too.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're delighted today to be speaking with Reverend Mark Elston. He lives and works at the intersection of money and meaning as an entrepreneur, nonprofit executive, and speaker. He's an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church USA. Today, we're talking about a recent book that he edited called Gone for Good, Negotiating the Coming Wave of Church Property Transition. Well, we've been talking about how a church sort of deals with closing down. But there's another trend that has been happening in response to these rapid demographic changes. It's not touched on so much in your book, Gone for Good, and it's what I might call the kind of big boxification of churches, growing to mega churches, or what we might call the franchise model, where there's one particular brand and multiple locations. And even though your book, Gone for Good, doesn't deal directly with that so much, I wonder if you would comment just briefly on how this other trend, besides churches closing, the 75 to 100 churches that are closing every day, these consolidations of congregations into mega churches or franchise churches, how is that affecting the dynamics of what we're talking about?
Yeah, first of all, I think it's important to note that the decline, the shrinking of participation is pretty widely spread now across a lot of different theological perspectives, a lot of different denominations or non-denominations. And so there was a little while there where I think the narrative was that a certain kinds of churches, mainline churches and so on, were closing while other non-denominational evangelical churches were booming. That is not really necessarily the case. Now, every individual church can have its own story. And of course, some of each are growing and some of each are not. But broadly speaking, even the mega churches, so to speak, are not growing the way they were. And some of them are actually shrinking. So I think that's important to know, one. But yes, there is also this kind of, which again is happening in other sort of sectors of our world. You've got Amazon, you know, online taking over the sale of literally everything that exists almost to the human species. And then you've got the struggling local store. And there's a bit of the same dynamic where there is a lot of economies of scale and a lot of draw to a fewer larger entities, while many of the smaller entities close or shift. Another caveat to that is that there is this movement in sort of house churches or dinner churches or churches that don't have property associated with them. And they might be really small, like micro churches that are made up of 12 people or something that, you know, gather weekly for a meal in someone's home, but they practice Christian life together and they would consider themselves a church. So you've got a lot of different things going on. But there has been, you are correct, this consolidation at the top with larger entities. And I think sometimes that's just related to the economics of it and the economics of managing property and all of what's involved with the staff and all of that.
Well, and I want to now build on this big box church question. And I'm speaking anecdotally here. I'm not drawing from data. But as I have interacted with big box churches, my impression has been they do branding very well. They don't do community so well. And they really don't do context and location well at all. They tend to be destination churches, oftentimes in large districts where there is suppression of the real estate market. So there's been historical, to go back to that word from earlier, there's been historical under-resourcing. And they come in as a kind of savior almost. Coast. So I want to ask you about these churches that are on the brink of demise as they're thinking about their pre-planning. There's a unique opportunity there for those kinds of churches to really listen to their community and to really reconnect with the context around them. And if I have that right, I would invite you to say more about that. If I've said it incorrectly, I'd invite you to tell me how you would say it.
No, I think that's right. I think there is an enormous opportunity to really listen deeply, carefully. There's a way in which actually, as we reach the point of closure or nearing closure or of just unsustainability, actually. So maybe doesn't mean closure of a church completely, but unsustainability of its previous model, that opens up new possibilities. If you're just cruising down the road, doing your thing and it's working, you don't have quite the same motivation. But when you start to realize that we're not cruising anymore and it's not working anymore, and then we need to look for different models, different ways of approaching this, then it does open up this opportunity to really listen, to really try to connect, to really think much more broadly, much more expansively about what it means to be the church in that location. And, you know, a lot of these churches that are in that situation are in amazing spots. They're in amazing locations. And pretty much in every corner, city, town, village in the United States. And so they not only have like their own opportunity, but there's this also like systemic social opportunity to really make the most of that while they're in that position of being able to do so.
Well, and as we're moving towards our next break, I want to ask you now, in that moment of opportunity, I would imagine, and this gets talked about a little bit in Gone for Good, a kind of what I'd call a flinch moment where, oh no, we can't even contemplate that. Oh no, we can't even, and there's a pulling back. How does a congregation get over the obstacle of that reflex of saying, we haven't been talking to our community, we don't know how to start?
Well, this might sound a little simplistic, but one response is to just start a little bit. So I get that, right? We don't know how to start, but we sometimes overthink it. It can begin with literally one conversation. Or, you know, it can begin with one listening session. I was in a conversation with some of the authors in the book, and one of them said, throw a party for your neighborhood. That's one of the best ways to find out what people really think. Doesn't need to be some formal process, whatnot. It's just throw a party and have people over and see what they think. So there's a little bit of just taking steps. We haven't exercised these muscles very often, and it's a bit like exercise, right? You don't want to maybe go out and go do a 100-mile bike ride on the first day when you're trying to get back into it, but maybe start with a 2-mile walk, you know, have a couple conversations and have a small thing and then start there and then build up that muscle and build up that ability to do some of this work. Sometimes we suggest churches experiment with small little projects before they engage in a big one. So if you're thinking about doing some kind of a kitchen-based thing, for example, or a food entrepreneur thing, maybe invite a local food cart to come for one night a month for 3 months of the summer and set up in your parking lot. Like start really simple, right? Come with a food cart one night a month for 3 months in the summer and see how that goes and start there rather than maybe starting with envisioning this massive, huge project right off the bat that becomes so overwhelming and gives you that flinch reaction of, oh no, we can't do that. Because you probably can do something. You probably have done something. I think most churches have done something, especially again in the last few years during the pandemic. So drawing upon that sort of muscle, that legacy, that ability to have done it before, and then building upon that is a useful way to start.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Mark Elston. He lives and works at the intersection of money and meaning as an entrepreneur, nonprofit executive, and speaker. He's the author of We Aren't Broke, Uncovering Hidden Resources for Mission and Ministry. He's an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church USA. Today we're talking about his recent book, which he edited, called Gone for Good, Negotiating the Coming Wave of Church Property Transition. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. Each week on our program, we bring you a rich conversation about culture and faith. If you're enjoying these conversations, please go to our website, thingsnotseenradio.com. There you'll find more than 10 years of these sorts of interviews and conversations, all available for free for your listening pleasure. We're talking today with Mark Elsden. He lives and works at the intersection of money and meaning as an entrepreneur, nonprofit executive, and speaker. He's the author of We Aren't Broke, Uncovering Hidden Resources for Mission and Ministry. He's an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church USA. Today, we're talking about a recent book that he edited called Gone for Good, Negotiating the Coming Wave of Church Property Transition. Well, one of the things I was glad to see really foregrounded in this edited volume, Gone for Good, is the idea of land acknowledgement and bringing indigenous communities back into conversation as these various church properties are in transition. And several of your authors who wrote essays talked about some aspects of this. And I wonder if you would be willing to give an overview for my listeners about what we're talking about here when we're talking about land recognition, conversation with indigenous persons as part of the church transition process.
Yeah, this was the one that was really important for me to include in the book. In fact, I don't think I would have actually published the book had this not been able to be a part of it. And it stems for me from this sort of personal sense that if we're talking about the disposition, the monetization, the sale, the development of church buildings and land, it's really important to not do that without recognition of where that land came from to begin with. And essentially, there aren't really any churches in the United States that aren't sitting on land that at one point was taken from communities of people that used that land. And of course, the way many modern American churches think about ownership is very different than how many First Nations people thought about ownership. But there we are thinking about selling something to make money off of it, developing something to make money off of it, or sometimes even we don't even know what to do with it. We have no idea what to do with it. And to that, I will often say, well, have you thought about just giving it back? If people want it, obviously, you don't give it back to people who don't. But if there's people, indigenous peoples in the area that are interested in making use of that land and building in some way, and it's valuable to them in some way, that can be a beautiful act of restoration to give it back. And so I guess that question, I feel like, needs to be in the room, in the conversation, whenever we start talking about the movement of this property or the use of this property in some other way. And so that's why I wanted to bring it up. It's a challenging couple chapters in the book for sure, and a challenging question to think about. And one of the authors, in fact, pushes it even further and says, we shouldn't simply be talking about this only when we're selling property, but even while we're still using it, do we want to think about these acts of restoration? And that takes it, you know, to another whole level. But again, I think is worth having a conversation about and certainly keeping very present in our minds.
Well, and one of the things that I really appreciated, and I can't recall who exactly said it, but there was an acknowledgement that when Anglos like me, so white people, hear this notion of restoration of indigenous persons to property and to lands, there is a sense in which, well, that means that every square inch of owned property needs to be given back. And there's a quotation, and I'm not going to be able to quote it directly, but many Native communities would say that would be trying to solve a suffering with a suffering, and that they're not seeking to just dispossess everyone of their heritage and of their land, but rather, exactly as you're saying, trying to find ways in which the historical connections can be regrounded and reacknowledged, and communities can be brought back into dialogue and into conversation about and invited to share in the use of these spaces. Now, I'm doing a lot of paraphrasing here. As I say all of this, have I got it basically right, or is there something that you would correct or add in what I've been saying?
Yeah, I'm always very reticent to speak for a community that I don't, you know, that I'm not a part of. And of course, the First Nations communities in the United States are extraordinarily varied in all kinds of different ways, location and culture and language and so on. So it's difficult to fully generalize. But I do think in some ways, the same principle as we've been talking about earlier applies, and that is getting to know your neighbors, getting to know the people for whom this land has a connection. And that includes the people it used, lived on, celebrated on that land long, long time ago. And so I think that would be the starting place I would encourage in that and into those conversations. And in some settings, it could well be that the their desires are one way and another setting's very different. But it's that same listening posture, not assuming necessarily that we know and listening for what would be a restorative action. But yeah, I think considering those questions is really important.
I really like the phrase you just used, listening posture, and I want to go a little deeper with this. So another example that was given from one of the essays in your edited book, Gone for Good, is, okay, we're trying to figure out how to reconnect with our community, and we don't have a huge amount of resources, but we do have a little bit of space. Why don't we open a coffee shop? And to me, as soon as I began to read that, a light bulb went off, because you're now not simply creating a space for consumption, like a bookshop or something like that, but you're creating a space that is natural for gathering and for conversations, where not just church members, but community members can begin to come in. And to me, that was the epitome of this phrase you've just used, a posture of listening, a willingness to open yourself up and to say to the community, not just what do we think that you need, but what do you need from us? And I wonder if you could build on this and talk to us about how do we re-enter this posture of listening that we seem to have lost, and what can we gain from something as simple as a cup of coffee together?
Yeah, I think it's a question somewhat of breaking down the walls, which maybe, you know, literally perhaps, but also figuratively breaking down some of the walls between the inside of the church and the outside of the church, right? And building relationship, just neighborly relationship. And what is it that people are dealing with in their life? What is it that they would love a church type space to do in their neighborhood? And, you know, examples like that are wonderful. Coffee shops. One church that we worked with was actually looking at taking its beloved food pantry ministry of 50 years and expanding it to be a neighborhood co-op grocery store. So a community-owned grocery store that would be a little bit more robust than a food pantry, that would be a bit more sustainable financially, and that would actually really address a food desert in their community in a way that the food pantry was never quite able to do. And then ideally, it'd be community-owned. So like a co-op, you know, rather than it being just some separately owned entity. That's another great example of how that all comes together. And then you have a place of mixing, you have a place of connection, you have a place that's meeting a real tangible need, and potentially also creating some value and perhaps even some wealth for the people that live in that neighborhood, all within the, you know, the mission and the property of that church.
Now, one of the things that also arises in the book Gone for Good is that when churches begin the process of transition, and they sort of move from the pre-development phase into the pre-development and development phases, they then enter not only into church deliberations, but into civic deliberations. And one of the things that was so helpful to me was at those moments, you have clashes of values. And suddenly you see that different groups of people come in and none of them are the bad guys. But all of them think in terms of their interests and their outcomes, and that can sometimes train wreck a process. And I've given a 30,000-foot view. I wonder if you can come down under the clouds and give us a little bit more of the details of the landscape here. What are we talking about when we're talking about entering into these civic processes of conversation and negotiation?
Yeah, so certainly if a church is going to do some sort of development on its property, just about any, but like housing, for example, or something like that, which there's a lot of conversation about, that's going to immediately put them into the city, what's called the city entitlement process, the approvals process, basically, which will involve neighborhood meetings, and it will involve the planning department and zoning and comprehensive plans and all these things that we may not have thought about so much as churches. And then it will, as you say, immediately involve what people might view as competing interests. So there might be some people that would love to see a certain type of project built on that property and others that would really not like to see that same type of project built on that property. And you have these moments of tension, perhaps even of clashing. In the best case scenario, those are creative tensions that lead to good outcomes. Not always the case. Sometimes they do get derailed and it just becomes really difficult to get things done. That's where, you know, it will require partnership for a church to do development with a developer and potentially other people. But again, I think it can be a creative space where people come to the table and push against each other a little bit and try to get to an outcome that maybe nobody loves as much as they would if it was all up to them, but hopefully everyone finds beneficial in some way for the sake of the neighborhood. I think one of the things that I'm really intrigued by and excited by in this work, especially on the development side, is here you have a landowner, the church, that's going to have a more, I would hope at least, a more community-oriented, social good-oriented posture with its land. It might be different than simply a real estate transaction that a developer might undergo just for the sake of building something. And so that, I think, opens up a whole lot of other possibilities of what might be done in development than might normally have been the case if it was just a straight up build whatever on that piece of land thing. And that's also where I think it's really important for churches to get involved in this if they can, and not just sell out to somebody, because then they've lost all control over what will get built there and that's it forever. It will never go back to something else. It will just be owned by whoever purchased it and developed however they choose. And so all of that is the messy goodness, you might say, of the situation. And it's the time that we're in. This is where we are. This is one of the things we've been handed as the American church in this moment to deal with, are these questions.
Well, and I'm going to use a phrase here that you don't use in your book, Gone for Good, because when you do write about it, you use the image of stone soup. And as you've been talking about this process, dealing with zoning boards and dealing with developers, pragmatism governs those processes. The profit motive governs those processes. But as I read this book and as I've been talking to you now, I'm hearing a different dynamic that animates you and your vision for this. What I might call not a pragmatic process, but a gospel process. That there is the possibility here for resurrection. There is the possibility here for hope. And I'd just love to give you a platform to talk for a few minutes about the hope that you see, and perhaps even the gospel that you see in this process.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You've heard that, and that is exactly the posture. That's what animates me about the work. If it was simply real estate transactions or simply pragmatic, that wouldn't be particularly interesting. I've recently been playing around with the term pragmatic, prophetic, prophetically pragmatic, and because I actually think both are important. I am very much a get it done person too. I don't want to just talk about simply ideas forever. I actually want to see us do some things and build some things and develop some things. And so in the end, those pragmatic steps need to be taken, but only if the vision where they're headed is going to be something beautiful, something good, something meaningful, some good news, which is, of course, the word gospel means, some good news. I think there's a lot of hope. I think there's a lot of opportunity here. And in some ways, by force, we're forced into this moment, but let's take advantage of it. And this is a lot of acreage of land available or will be available to do different things on. And there was a study in California done by UC Berkeley that found that I think enough acreage that would be larger than the city of Stockton, California is available in California by churches to build affordable housing, for example. That's without even tearing down any of the existing structures on those properties. That's just unused property in the state of California. So it's a huge opportunity throughout the United States to construct and make use of these things in new ways. And to me, that's what's most exciting about it. And in the end, yes, pragmatic decisions and practical considerations have to be made to make them work and to get them done. But it all starts with that vision and with that question of what are we about and what are we trying to do here and what are we trying to see happen in our neighborhood?
That's what I appreciate so much about both your essays in the book Gone for Good, but also the essays that you have gathered here, is that consistently there is this view towards the positive outcomes, the opportunities, and as we've begun to say here in the conversation, the kind of gospel possibilities here. And even to go back to something like the reconnecting of Indigenous and First Nations persons to land, there's a gospel and a resurrection narrative that is involved in that as well. So as we are doing this, let's come back to a question that you introduced early in our conversation. As you look at these processes, as you look at this data and these trend lines, as you imagine and vision out 50 years, what does the church look like if it embraces these opportunities and makes the most of these gospel moments? What's the best we can hope for?
Yeah, I think in my view, you know, if we look out 50 years is a long time. It's 20 years, right? But sure, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years. I envision a church, a big C, broadly speaking, church that is full of all kinds of different expressions of what it means to be a gathered Christian community. It's, again, it's grocery co-ops. It's healthcare centers using rural churches for healthcare clinics. It's affordable housing projects that are meeting real needs in a neighborhood. It's co-working spaces and early childhood education and worship. It's all of that. It's just a broader array, a beautiful mixture. I do use in the book the analogy of stone soup, which is the story of people coming together and putting a whole bunch of different ingredients in one by one, and then they create something beautiful together. To me, that is the vision of what it could be. And we've done it before, and we know how to do it. It isn't actually totally really that new. It's just trying to live into that and live into it on a perhaps a different scale with regard to the property, at least. But I think there's a lot to be hopeful for and to look forward to in that if we can do it with intentionality and with focus.
Well, Mark Elston, we have barely begun to scratch the surface of your book, Gone for Good, and all the different essays that you have gathered here. I found it fascinating. It was informative. They are digestible reads. None of them is more than about 10 pages long, so a person can sit down and take this book in chunks. But every time that they come to this book, Gone for Good, they're going to be rewarded with a different facet of the vision that you've been talking about with us here. I'm so grateful that you took the time to gather these voices and to edit this book, but I'm especially grateful that you took the time to talk about it with me and my listeners today.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking today with Mark Elston. He lives and works at the intersection of money and meaning as an entrepreneur, nonprofit executive, and speaker. He's the author of We Aren't Broke, Uncovering Hidden Resources for Mission and Ministry. He holds degrees from the University of California, Berkeley, from Princeton Theological Seminary, and from the University of Wisconsin School of Business. Mark Elston is an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church USA, and he lives in Madison, Wisconsin. Today, we've been discussing a book that he edited called Gone for Good, Negotiating the Coming Wave of Church Property Transition.
Things Not Seen is produced by Sandberg Media, LLC. We're distributed nationally by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Today's show was recorded at the William Adams Studios in beautiful Hyde Park, here on the south side of Chicago, Illinois. Our theme music is composed by Gene Kija. Our show is made possible in part by the generosity of supporters on Patreon. You can find out how to help us create great programs by going to patreon.com/notseenradio. You can follow us on Twitter at notseenradio. Visit us on Facebook and like our page to receive regular updates about the show and find out more about our guests. That's facebook.com/thingsnotseenradio. And you can sign up for the free podcast, listen to old shows, send us an email, and find out more about our guests if you visit us on the web at thingsnotseenradio.com. I'm David Dalt, and we'll be back next week with more conversations about culture and faith. Please join us.